Brother, now, a number of years ago, when I was attending Ambassador College, one of my professors one day was up addressing the entire student body. And in the lecture that he made a particular point I'd like to share with you by way of introduction today. He made the comment that all learning in life is experiential. But one of the keys in life is we don't always have to be the one doing the experiencing. The point he was trying to get at is there's a number of lessons in life we don't have to learn the hard way. That if we're willing to learn from the experiences of others, there's a lot of pain that we can avoid in life, than not having to go through it ourselves. While there are certainly lessons that in life that you can't learn from other people, that you just have to go through. You can't really learn it by studying about it or, being advised about it from others. There are certainly lessons like that in that category. But there are a lot of things in life that we can learn, the easy way, you might say, rather than having to go through it through personal experience if we're willing to do that. And just in researching this sermon, I did a little research on the internet just to share with you some famous quotes in regards to, you might say, the lessons of history. So just start off with, I'd like to share a couple of these. This first one is attributed to Aldous Huxley. And the quote goes, "That men do not learn very much from the lessons of history is the most important of all lesson of history." And there's another one here. This is actually attributed to an anonymous source, but I just really liked this particular quote. It says, "History repeats itself because no one was listening the first time." And when you think about that, that's kind of what we're going to look at today. Because as I mentioned, there are a number of things in life that we can learn from others that we don't have to learn through personal experience. And we can avoid a lot of pain in life if we're willing to do that. In fact, it was based on this very principle that God recorded the Bible for us. If we'll start off by way of introduction, turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. We'll see here where the Apostle Paul tells us that this is kind of the very logic of why God recorded the Bible for us. And so we could learn from the examples of others and not have to learn a lot of lessons, the hard way, you might say. So it's 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, they drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." And now notice verse 6. "Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." In other words, the reason that this was recorded was in the hopes that we would learn the easy way, that we would learn from the experiences of others. And continuing in verse 7, "And do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor murmur, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." In other words, what Paul is saying here is the very reason these stories were recorded for us was for our admonition in the hopes that we would take heed, that we would learn from this and not have to learn a lot of these lessons the hard way. That we would be willing to learn from the examples of others and just take their word for it and apply those principles rather than doing it the hard way. Well, we're going to focus on this idea of not having to learn the hard way in this sermon. In fact, what we're going to specifically do is look at the life of a biblical character known for his wisdom, known for his great wisdom and his great understanding that he was blessed with from God. And as I'm sure as I mentioned that, a lot of you are immediately thinking of Solomon, and you're correct, that's exactly where we're going. And what we're going to see in the life of Solomon is even though he is given a tremendous gift of wisdom, there are still some big mistakes he made in his life. And in many ways, they weren't what you might say the more complicated areas, or he wasn't covering new territory that hadn't been addressed before and he wasn't sure what to do. In the areas of his life where he made big mistakes, Moses had already recorded instructions not to do the things that he did. And so he wound up having to learn the hard way in a number of areas in his life because, typical of human nature, he wasn't willing to learn the easy way. So if you'd like a title for the sermon, and it's a little bit of a long title, it's Learning the Hard Way, Lessons from the Life of Solomon, Part 1. And I say Part 1 because it's going to take two sermons to cover this entire subject. But again, that's Learning the Hard Way, Lessons from the Life of Solomon, Part 1. So to start off with, let's take a look at the life of Solomon. Let's turn over to 1 Kings chapter 3. And we're going to start with, I think, a very familiar story to most all of us that we typically tend to think of when we think of the life of Solomon. It's 1 Kings chapter 3. And before we start reading, I'd just like to set up a little bit of history here. As I'm sure most of us are aware, Solomon is the king, is the son of King David. So when he basically, you know, comes into power, you know, he was raised basically in the king's palace, you might say, and was, you know, raised by his father who was king, who is a, you know, man after God's own heart, as the Bible tells us. So he had the advantages, you know, of being raised in this environment. He also, being king, we know for sure he would have had access to the writings of Moses and Joshua and others who had come before him. In fact, for the kings of Israel, it was a requirement that God laid out that the kings had to write their own copy of the law. You know, so and the idea there was that they would definitely be familiar with what was written in the books of the law that Moses had written. So we know for sure Solomon would have had access to all of that. And I point that out because as we're going to see today, some of the major mistakes that he made were things directly that Moses had spoken to, you know, and just Solomon chose to learn it the hard way. But let's just start off here in 1 Kings chapter 3 in verse 1. It says, Now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. And then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now, I'd like to pause here just for a second to point out that notice that this particular marriage came about as a result of a political alliance. In which, you know, Solomon is making a deal with the king, you know, with Pharaoh over Egypt. And as a part of kind of brokering that deal, Pharaoh gives his daughter to Solomon as a wife. It was not an uncommon practice at that time because, you know, when nations were making a deal like this, now the other king has family connections, you might say that the king of nation A now has family connections with nation B. And that, you know, kind of gives him more of a motivation to follow through on whatever the agreement, you know, that they came to was. And that was not an uncommon practice at this time. But I just point this out because later today we're going to look at the number of wives that Solomon had. And just be aware that a number of these came about as a result of these political alliances. Now, picking up in verse 2, Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Now notice here in the narrative that God inspires, Solomon gets a very positive rating. You know, he's saying basically at this point in his life, God says he's doing a pretty good job. He's lived a pretty good life. God just has one particular issue with him. And I point that out because we're going to see later in his life the situation changes. But continuing in verse 4, Now the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, and there was a great high place, and Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. And at Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, Ask what I shall give you. And Solomon said, You have shown great mercy to your servant David my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. And you have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is to this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David. But I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of the people whom you have chosen, a great people too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart, to judge your people, that I may be discerned between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? Now, when we think of the scene that's playing out here, I'm sure at various times in our lifetimes we've seen the movies or cartoons or other stories where they have a genie, and then the genie comes out of the bottle and says, tell me what your wishes are and I'll grant your wishes. Well, this is kind of a similar scenario. And then that God is going to Solomon saying, you know, tell me what you'd like and I'll grant what your wish is. But if we notice here how Solomon responds, this is very pleasing to God because Solomon doesn't say, hey, make me rich, make me powerful, you know, do something to make me prominent. What he asks for is a discerning heart. He says, give me wisdom that I can, you know, do this job that you've given me to take care of your people. I notice he said, I want a discerning heart to know good from evil. He's asking God to basically define for him what is good and what is evil. Now, if we remember the story in Genesis, that there were two trees, you know, with Adam and Eve in the garden. And God specifically told them of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's the one tree I want you to avoid. And of course, as we know, Adam and Eve went and partook of it anyway. But symbolically, what that represented was they were taking upon for themselves, you know, the decision to decide what was good and what was evil in their own viewpoint, rather than looking to God to define that for them. And I point this out because what Solomon is saying here is, I want you to give me a discerning heart from your perspective, from your wisdom, to show me what is good and what is evil. He's looking to God to define good versus evil. And I point that out because we're going to see in part two later in his life, he winds up doing the opposite of this. Later in his life, he winds up trying to take upon himself to decide that rather than having God do it. Also take note of the fact of the humility that he's showing here. He says, I'm but a little child. I don't know how to go out or how to come in, and I need you to show me. You know, so again, he's small in his own eyes, and he's also at this point in his life looking out for the good of all. Notice, because he doesn't ask for something that's just for his own benefit. You know, he asks for a discerning heart so it will edify everyone. He's basically talking about a principle here that he tells us later in Proverbs, you know, when the righteous are in power, the people rejoice. Because that's what he's asking for. If I can reign, you know, according to your will, it'll be good for everyone. So he's looking out for the overall good of others. And I just point that out because later we're going to see in his life how that perspective changes. But let's pick up now in verse 10. And the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself an understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been any one like you before you, nor shall any be like you after you. We're basically being told here that Solomon is the wisest man who would ever live in human existence. You know, because it says, you know, there wouldn't be a wiser person before him, nor would there come one after him. So this is, you know, unequivocally the wisest man who's ever lived in human history. And notice in verse 13, I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be any one like you among all the kings all of your days. I notice he has promised to be the wisest man in human history, but in terms of wealth, he's told, you'll be the richest man of your time. You know, so I mean, to make it analogous to our day today, he was like the Bill Gates, the Warren Buffett, the Donald Trump, you might say, of his time. You know, today we would call him a billionaire. It's essentially what Solomon became in his time. What we're also going to see as we go through this series, you know, it's often said that a person's greatest strength can also be their greatest weakness. You know, it's something that can really be a blessing to us, and it can also be a problem as well. This can also be true of gifts that we're given, you know, even gifts from God, that if we don't handle them well, we can turn a blessing into a curse, you know, and it can wind up being a stumbling block for us if we don't handle it well. And we're going to see that both of these things and the way that Solomon handled them wound up, you know, he kind of turned them into negatives. But we'll see that later in this series. And picking up in verse 14, so if you walk in my ways and keep my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. And then Solomon awoke, and indeed it had been a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, offered up burnt offerings and offered peace offerings, and made a feast for all of his servants. Again, take note of the fact that at this point in his life, where is his focus? It's on the overall good for everyone. He's not just looking to make himself happy, you know, and to please himself. Even when he throws a feast, it's, hey, let's do this in a way that edifies lots of people. It looks out for the good of others. And I point that out because we're going to see in the second part of this series that perspective of looking out for others very much changes in his life. But just to sum up here, notice that Solomon is given in a tremendous gift of wisdom, you know, from God. The God has granted him, as it says here, to be the wisest man in human history. Now, he became quite famous in his time as a result of this. And let's see some examples here. Turn over to 1 Kings chapter 4, and we'll pick up in verse 29. Because what we're going to see here is not only was he known throughout Israel for his incredible wisdom, he became known amongst all the surrounding nations in his time because of his wisdom. Again, if you turn over to 1 Kings 4 and verse 29, we'll pick up the story here. It says, "And God gave Solomon wisdom, exceedingly great understanding, and largeness of heart like the sand of the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan, the Azurite, and Heman, and Chakol, and Darda, and the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in the surrounding nations." In other words, he became famous because of this. "And he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And he spoke of trees from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop and springs out of the wall. He spoke of animals and of birds and of creeping things and of fish. And of men of all the nations from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon." Now notice two things here. He isn't just given a gift of godly wisdom. He is given a gift of great understanding of just even nature. As it says, of plants, of animals, just the world around him. He's just given great intellect and understanding in addition to just godly wisdom. And not only that, this was so much so that this became noticed by the nations around him. You know, the rulers and those of the nations around him all knew about Solomon's wisdom and came to be taught by him. This kind of makes him a superstar. Let's see an example of this. Turn over to 1 Kings chapter 10. It's 1 Kings chapter 10. We're going to see an example here of a particular leader, the Queen of Sheba, that came to him again because of his wisdom. And it's 1 Kings chapter 10 and verse 1. It says, "Now when the Queen of Sheba heard the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions." And when she came to challenge him and see if she could stump him. "And she came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue and with camels that bore spices, very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So Solomon answered all of her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he could not explain it to her." In other words, you know, she challenged him with the best that she had, and he could answer anything. And picking up in verse 4, "And when the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon in the house that he had built, the food on his table, and the seeing of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel, his cupbearers and his entryway by which he went into the house of the Lord, that there was no more spirit in her." In other words, she's just overwhelmed by seeing this. "And then she said to the king, 'It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I did not believe the words until I came and saw it with my own eyes. And indeed, the half was not told to me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceed the fame of which I have heard. And happy are your men, and happy are your servants who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you and setting you in the throne of Israel. Because the Lord has loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness." And notice, I mean, the stories that she had heard, you know, through word of mouth in her own land, she thought that just sounds too incredible. This just can't be right. I've got to go check this out myself. So she comes and presents to him, you know, his most difficult situation she can, and then she's blown away. She's like, this guy answered everything. In fact, the stories didn't do this justice. This guy's more incredible than I even heard. You know, so I mean, if you think about this, it's ironic what we're going to see in this man's life of some of the decisions that he made. Because notice, this is the guy that, you know, we're directly told is the wisest man that's lived in human history. He is famous. He astounds people with his understanding. But at the same time, what we're going to see when we look later in his life, it's astounding, to be blunt about it, some of the dumb decisions that he made in his life, in spite of the incredible wisdom he's gifted with. Because, see, there's a big lesson in human nature with this. There's a difference between having knowledge and understanding or even wisdom and having character. Because you can understand the right things to do, that doesn't necessarily mean you have the character to actually put it into practice. Or oftentimes to say no to yourself. Because oftentimes as carnal human beings, isn't that oftentimes one of the most difficult things we do? When we really want something and we know it's not the right thing and we have to, you know, rein in our human nature and say no, that can be some of the most difficult things. You know, and again, it's oftentimes that carnal human nature that causes us to make decisions or to justify in our own minds to do things that we have better sense than to do. Because what we're about to see in Solomon's life is the things that were kind of his downfall, they weren't complicated things that, you know, of issues that had never been faced before that he wasn't sure what to do. They were issues that, you know, Moses had made very clear how one should respond and had documented the instruction. Solomon just refused to do it in his own life. So let's turn over to 1 Kings chapter 11. And what we're going to see here is some of the mistakes that Solomon made. It's 1 Kings chapter 11 in verse 1. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. And from the nation of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you, for surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. And Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For so it was when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, and as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites, and Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. And Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and on the hill that is in the east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all of his foreign wives, and burned incense and sacrifice to their gods. Now notice he is directly being involved in pagan worship, in worshiping of other gods. But how did he get there? And what we're going to see in this chapter, there's two major mistakes that he made. And again, these weren't issues that had never been previously addressed. These were things where Moses and Joshua and others had recorded specific instructions not to do this. And Solomon obviously had to be aware of it. But again, there's a difference between character and an understanding. In other words, the ability, you know, to carry it out. And our carnal human nature can also play tricks with us and cause us to justify in our own minds why I'll be the exception. It'll be okay for me to violate the rules. It'll work out for me. I can stick my hand in that fire and not get burned. Because that's what we very often tend to tell ourselves. Well, let's look at these two different decisions that Solomon made kind of one at a time. One of them, as is, you know, was previously mentioned in this chapter, you know, Moses had recorded specifically that Israel had been commanded by God not to marry pagan women. You know, so let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 7. It's Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 1. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess, and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than you. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. And you shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. Nor shall you make marriages with them, and you shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, so the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. Now notice, first of all, that what the issue is about here is turning the heart after other gods. So this really isn't so much of a nationality issue as this is a religious issue. And if you also notice when you know Solomon was being addressed with this in 1 Kings 11, one of the groups that's mentioned as far as women that he married was women of the Moabites. And now if you look in the Old Testament history, if you remember, Ruth was a Moabite. You know, in the book of Ruth where she marries Boaz. Now God actually arranged this marriage. If you read through the story, God obviously works behind the scenes to bring Ruth and Boaz together. And if you also look at the lineage of Jesus Christ, he's a descendant of Boaz. That's the lineage that was, you know, his descent came from. You know, so why did God do this? Because it wasn't a religious issue at that point. So see, Ruth had already said to Naomi, "Your God shall be my God, and I shall follow you." In other words, she had already given up the gods of the Moabites and decided she was going to follow the God of Israel. You know, so it was no longer a religious issue because this really wasn't about nationality. This was about religion. And if you think about it, the wise advice that Moses was giving here is not to be basically to set ourselves up. Because when you think about it, what is a lot of marriage about? It's about compromising a lot of cases, isn't it? I mean, and learning how to get along with each other. Because, I mean, just being male and female alone, we have, you know, different ways that we're wired and different priorities and different likes and dislikes, you know, and not only just, you know, different personalities and such. As a part of getting along with each other, there's a decent amount of negotiation that takes place, you know, just in learning how to get along and work with one another. You know, well, one of the places you don't want to be in is where your religion becomes one of the issues, you know, of that negotiation. Because if you think about the situation that Solomon got put in, like I'll just use an example. Like I found this humorous when this was said to me a few months ago when I was first putting together the idea of this sermon. I was discussing it with my sister. And we were just kind of talking about Solomon and some of his mistakes. And we were kind of joking on the phone and she commented to me and she goes, "Well, you know what Solomon heard, don't you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Oh, it went something like this." She goes, "Some of the wives came to him and said, 'Well, Solomon, if you really loved me, if you really cared about me, you would build an altar to my God. You know, because you know, we can be involved in your worship and worship your God, but if you really loved me, you would build an altar to my God.'" You know, and she goes, "Well, then after he did it for the first one, you know what happened then?" And I chuckled. I said, "No, what do you mean?" She goes, "It went something like this. The other wives came to him and said, 'Well, if you loved me as much as you loved her,'" she goes, "'well, you build an altar to my God.'" And she goes, "And he got himself in the middle of this situation. It was one of the things that led to him, you know, winding up, you know, doing this for multiple wives." She goes, "This is kind of the situation he got himself put in." Well, if you look here, let's look at a number of other times in the Bible. This same instruction is given to us throughout time. It wasn't just Moses who recorded this. It's also in the book of Joshua. We'll turn now over to Joshua chapter 23. Joshua chapter 23 in verse 11. It says, "Therefore take diligent heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God. Or else if indeed you go back and cling to the remnant of these nations and these that remain among you and make marriages with them and go into them and they to you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you. But they shall be snares and traps for you, and scourges on your eyes and thorns in your eyes, until you perish in this good land which the Lord your God has given you." So if you notice here, he mentioned this being a snare and a trap. If you think about how relationships tend to work out, you know, when you're getting attracted to someone, what tends to happen? Our emotions get involved, our hormones get involved, and that affects our ability to think clearly, doesn't it? I mean, that's just kind of a natural human tendency. You know, and that's what can lead a person into making these kind of decisions, and then later it can bite you. Because think about living a life with someone, you know, and you feel strongly about your religious beliefs, and they feel strongly about religious beliefs that are completely the opposite. You know, and it especially becomes an issue if you're having children. I mean, think about that. If you want to handle, you know, you want to keep the holy days and the feast and other things of that nature, well, you have someone else who wants to keep Christmas and Easter and Halloween, and especially if you have children, you know, now both of you wants to teach the child your way of life, in your belief system. Think about where this puts a child into. This is where it can kind of set up to be a snare in a problem. Now turn over to the book of Nehemiah. We'll see a specific example where he addresses this, particularly in the realm of how it affected children. In Nehemiah chapter 13, in verse 23. It's Nehemiah 13 and verse 23. It says, in those days I saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair. And made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives, you know, to their sons, nor make their daughters for your sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused him to sin. In other words, this tripped him up, even the wisest man who'd ever lived. And should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? I notice he mentioned how the language ability what was affecting the children. You know, well, think about it. At this time, you know, the Bible, at least what they had of it at that time, it's written in Hebrew. And if they're raising children now that no longer speak the language of Israel, but the language of the other nations, how do they even study God's word? You can see that the issues that that would create. But if you put that in a modern day context, I mean, think of it like the example I used previously. What if one of you wants to teach your child to keep the Sabbath, to keep the holy days, to observe God's festivals? Well, the other parent wants to teach them Christmas, Easter, Halloween, and all the other traditions, you know, that they're familiar with. Think of the situation this puts a kid in, kind of being pulled back and forth between these. This is why he advises against this. And see, this is also an instruction we get in the New Testament as well. Turn me over to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. It's 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. It says, do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? And what part has the believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord, and do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. And I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord God Almighty. See, Paul is basically teaching the same principle that was taught in the Old Testament. But, you know, in today's Church of God environment, it's not, I wouldn't say it's just an issue of looking at, are we both part of the Church of God? I think it's also important in entering a relationship like that, we make sure that we're on the same page with one another. And understand, I'm not in any way defining this by corporational boundaries. You know, that's a common mentality in today's world. And 1 Corinthians 1 and 1 Corinthians 3 is very, you know, staunchly against, you know, what we today would call the corporational mentality. But I think it is important to make sure we're on the same page doctrinally, you know, when entering into a relationship like that. Because think about it like this. So you both believe in the holy days. If one of you believes in the traditional Hebrew calendar and one of you believes in an alternate calendar, because there's numerous alternate calendars, it's not just one, how do you go to the same feast site together and agree on where you're going and how to do this when you don't even agree on what days they are? You know, you're not even on the same page. So I think it's important in entering into a relationship like that to make sure that you're on the same page and you know, can agree with each other. Because if you think about, you have a divorce rate today in America of at least about 50% for first marriages. Why put yourself in a situation where, you know, a major issue like this in your life, you're in major disagreement about? Well, let's turn back over to 1 Kings chapter 3. actually like chapter 11, I should say, kind of pick up where we left off here. Let's look at the other side of what Solomon did here. 1 Kings chapter 11. We're going to start off by rereading verse 3, because we're going to look at here the number of wives that this man chose to have. And it's 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 3. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Now, first of all, what I'd like to address is what the Bible is really getting at when it refers to a concubine. Now, I have to admit, a lot of my life, I read this, and when I would read concubine, in my mind, that meant mistress or girlfriend, you know, as we would oftentimes look at it today. You know, with the thought being, well, you know, he had 700 wives and, well, 300 mistresses that, you know, he kind of had on the side. And that's not exactly the idea of what the Bible is getting across when it says this. So just to cover that point, let's look at the Hebrew word that is translated here as concubine. It is transliterated into English as pilegis. It's P-I-Y-L-E-G-E-S. It's Strong's number 6370. And according to the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Warren Baker, here's how it's defined. A feminine noun meaning a concubine. A concubine was a legitimate wife. However, she was of secondary rank. This was evident by the references to the concubine as having a husband, Judges 19, verse 2, and that this man and her father are considered to be son-in-law, Judges 19, verse 5, and father-in-law, Judges 19, verse 4, respectively. Now, I won't take the time to read through the story in Judges 19, but if you read through that particular story, you get the clear meaning there that a concubine there was, again, not just a mistress. There was a formal relationship, like a marriage between them. It was just considered of a lesser status than a full wife. And the point I'm kind of getting at in saying this is, you know, that essentially what the Bible is telling us is that a Solomon had 1,000 wives. Now, this was another thing that he, you know, Moses had recorded that kings should not do. And you'll turn me over to Deuteronomy chapter 17. It's Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 14. And when you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like the nations that are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren. You shall not set his king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord your God has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. So you can see, I mean, the instructions were here very clearly. Don't do this. Don't have multiple wives. But Solomon did it exponentially more than most others had done. I mean, even his father David made this mistake of having multiple wives, but nowhere close to what Solomon had done. Now, but let's just take a moment, and I'll warn you ahead of time, I'm going to have a little fun we're talking about this particular subject. Because when I look at the situation that Solomon put himself in, this is, quite frankly, I guess a great lesson in human nature, to realize that the wisest man who's ever lived in human history somehow convinced himself this was a good idea. Because if you just kind of walk through the logistics of what this would do to his life, you know, I mean, having been married for 14 years myself, and even at one point in my career having been a marriage therapist, I look at this and I shake my head and I go, how did a man so wise convince himself that this was somehow going to be a good idea? This is going to be a disaster. Because I mean, just think this through. Think about the sheer numbers of what he is dealing with. With 1,000 women, there is no way he is going to spend any meaningful amount of time with a vast majority of these women. You know, so when you look at the story, and this is what I always kind of think of in my head when I read through 1 Kings 11 and I hear, you know, the description of the 1,000 women, I always kind of picture myself in a conversation with Solomon, you know, kind of what this would be like. And I just sit there and want to go, Solomon, Have you never heard of jealousy? Have you never heard of unity against a common enemy? Because if you're not familiar with these concepts, boy, you're going to be by the time this is done. Because if you just think through the logistics of what this is going to do, just by the sheer numbers, as I mentioned, a lot of these women he's going to spend no meaningful time with because he just simply can't, that's not logistically possible. Also by common sense, just looking at, different personalities in such, some of these women he's going to hit it off with more than he is with others. That's just common sense. But some he's going to have more things in common with, their personalities are going to mesh a little more, and he's probably going to spend more time with them, kind of favor them over some of the others. What's that naturally going to result in? A lot of jealousy. I mean, all you have to do is look at the other examples of polygamy in the Old Testament to kind of see the jealousy, the vying for attention, the infighting that's kind of results in. He's got hundreds of wives. Just imagine the situation that this is going to create. Also imagine this. If he's got this many different women, and again, a large percentage of them he's going to spend little to no time with. Of course, I'm sure a lot of them came about as a result of political alliances, so there was no real connection, between him and, she was just part of his harem and part of a deal that he made. But still, think about the feelings of abandonment, resentment, loneliness that these women are likely to experience in what they're going to go through and what kind of negative feelings this is going to result in. Then what are they going to do? Well, naturally, a lot of them are going to do what is very natural for a woman to do when she's hurting and going through a situation like that. She's going to want to reach out to others, have someone to talk to, a shoulder to cry on, someone who's going to understand her hurt and what she's going through and is going to validate her experience. And what are they going to discover? There's hundreds of other women who know exactly how they feel. And then what's this going to do? They're going to fertilize each other's negative feelings towards him because they all have one thing in common. It's that same neglectful husband that is the source of all their negative feelings. Now we've got unity against a common enemy. And guess who the common enemy is? The rocket scientist who thought having 1,000 wives was somehow going to be a good idea. He's setting himself up for disaster. And if you think about the situation that he had to put himself in, there was a very difficult lesson that he really learned the hard way. That if he had simply followed Moses' instruction of don't do this, don't have multiple wives, you'll save yourself a lot of pain, he could have skipped. But he records a lesson for us 5 different times throughout the book of Proverbs. And I think one of the reasons it's talked about so many times like that is because this was a lesson he learned in spades through his own personal experience, and he learned it the hard way. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 21. Proverbs chapter 21, we're going to start in verse 9. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman, let alone hundreds of them. Now turn over to verse 19 of chapter 21. It is better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. Again, let alone hundreds of them. Now turn to Proverbs chapter 25. Proverbs 25 and verse 24. It is better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. And again, Proverbs chapter 27, verse 15. A continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Whoever restrains her restrains the wind and grasps oil in his right hand. Now, if you've ever listened to, I just use the analogy today of like a dripping faucet. If you ever tried to sleep or something and you just kind of hear that constant drip, 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 drip. Well, what does that do after time? Your nerves are just kind of get on edge after a while. You're like, somebody fix that thing or turn that thing off. That's kind of the analogy he's making here. or like he says, grasping oil in your hand. Well, what happens if you try to grasp oil in your hand and squeeze it? Well, you squeeze your hand and the oil just runs down your arms. What happens? Or if you try to grasp the wind, I mean, you can try to grasp air. All it does is slip out of your hand. You know, that's the analogy he's making here. And one final scripture on this point, turn over to Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 13. A foolish son is the ruin of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dripping. In other words, the same idea of kind of dripping water or a dripping faucet that gets on your nerves. And understand, I'm not covering this to, you know, from a sense to try to pick on the ladies hearing this, you know, because I mean, although this is a biblical principle, realize Solomon set himself up for this. If he had been willing to learn the easy way and had followed Moses' instructions and not insisted on having to, you know, to learn this the hard way through personal experience, he wouldn't have had to go through this. You know, it was something he insisted through his own human nature to put himself into. You know, as I mentioned, I'm just going to have a little bit of fun with it, with this subject. But, you know, when I think of Solomon's situation, it reminds me of a humorous poster I saw one time. And this will kind of show you, I guess, what a warped sense of humor I have. But I'm sure a lot of you have seen these motivational posters. You know, you'll see them in office buildings or in various places, and it'll be a picture of a mountain or a guy climbing a mountain or, you know, or something of that kind of nature. And it has, you know, some message under it about, you know, courage or commitment or perseverance or something of that nature. You know, well, there's also these ones that you'll see that are kind of a parody of that, that are done for kind of sarcastic humor. And there's one that I always think of when I read Solomon's example. In fact, I actually have a copy of this particular poster up on my Facebook page. It's a picture of a banister. You know, it's kind of like you would see around a back porch or, you know, around a deck or something, kind of a wood banister around it. And on this banister, now realize this particular photo is most likely photoshopped and been faked. But just so you appreciate the humor of it. What it shows on this banister is a fully grown bald eagle. And this bald eagle is perched on the banister and he's kind of looking off to one side. And in the direction where he's looking, you also see this house cat. And this house cat is crouched down like he's stalking, and he's, you know, making his way over towards the eagle. You know, the obvious implication is like he's hunting birds, you know, but the bird he's about to try to take on is big enough to just pick him up, fly away, take him to a nest, and have him for lunch. You know, well, underneath the picture, in big letters is the word overconfidence. You know, and then underneath that in smaller letters, the caption says, "This is going to end in disaster, and you only have yourself to blame." You know, well, when I look at this going, the wisest man in the world decided that having 1,000 wives was a good idea, and this was going to turn out and somehow make his life fulfilling. I look at that and think, overconfidence. This is going to end in disaster, and you only have yourself to blame. You know, but because it's a great lesson in human nature. But because common sense would tell most all of us, this is going to be a bad idea. But somehow this is a guy that talked himself into thinking, it'll work out for me. I'll be the exception. I can do something boneheadedly stupid, but it'll still work out okay for me. Somehow, you know, it'll work when I do it. I'm the exception. You know, isn't that what we all tell ourselves when we kind of, you know, avoid obvious good counsel and go against obvious basic principles? Because that's what we tend to do. You know, as any good sales trainer will tell you, if you've ever worked in the sales industry at all and been through any professional training with that, one of the concepts they tend to teach is it is a natural human tendency for people to make decisions with emotion and then reverse engineer a logic to make that decision make sense. You know, because we'll look at something and our own emotional desires, our own lust or whatever we want to do this, you know, because we just want it. Even though in the back of our minds we know it's a bad idea, it's not going to work out well, it defies basic principles that I shouldn't be going against, we create a logic in our minds that'll make it make sense so we can justify it to ourselves. It's a natural human tendency. You know, so when you look at these kind of decisions, it's kind of obvious at some level Solomon was doing this. Because why would a person so wise do something so boneheadedly stupid? You know, it's because of our human nature. It's our human nature, our carnality, the inability to tell ourselves no, and the deceptiveness of human nature, of how we can talk ourselves into believing this is a good idea because it's really what I want to do. Even though it doesn't make sense, for whatever reason, I want to do it, so I'll talk myself into doing it. And that's essentially a lot of what occurred here. Well, let's also look at some other lessons in Solomon's life. Turn back over to 1 Kings. Let's pick up where we left off here. 1 Kings chapter 11. We'll pick up in verse 9 here where we left off, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 9. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. In other words, he knew better. He just couldn't, you know, harness his own human nature to do the right thing. He didn't do this out of lack of knowledge or a lack of awareness that this was the right thing. He did this because he was carnal and he was stubborn, and he decided to go against, you know, God's instructions. It says, therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Now notice what he's saying here. God is basically pronouncing sentence upon him. He said, look, I've tried to get you to go the right direction. You're insisting on going the wrong way, and here's the consequences you're going to face. But notice also that there's another lesson in this, that Solomon's sins had a ripple effect. It didn't just affect his life. Being the king, he wound up affecting the whole nation as a result of the mistakes that he had made. It's an important lesson in regards to sin itself. The analogy I like to use is sin is oftentimes like taking a rock and throwing it into some water. If you've ever gone out to like a pond or, you know, a still body of water and taken a stone and thrown it in the water, what you're going to see is a shock wave goes out in every direction away from where the stone hits. And the larger the stone is, the bigger the shock wave that goes out. And those rings go out again in every direction. And again, the larger the stone, the more they are. Well, sin has a similar effect, because this is what happened in Solomon's life. His sins didn't just affect him and affect his family. They wound up affecting the entire nation. But also, I mean, if you just think through what this would do to his family, I mean, think through not only the number of wives that he had, but the children that had to come from this. But because, you know, one of the things that would have gotten him into having this many women was his own lust, his own sex drive. Because as we're going to see in part two, he says in Ecclesiastes, he got to a point where he decided, you know, whatever appealed to his eyes, he didn't withhold from himself. Well, you know, one of the things that happened here was, hey, she's gorgeous, and she's gorgeous, and she's gorgeous. I think I'll have them all. You know, obviously some version of that is, you know, what fueled a lot of this in having them all together. Of course, there was also political alliances. There was desire for power. There were a number of things that were playing a part in this. But the point I'm getting at is, you know, as a result of this, there would be a good number of children, because his sex drive was probably one of the things that caused him to go down this road. Well, in the other examples, of course, the Bible doesn't tell us a lot about his children or anything that came from that. But if you look at the other examples of some of the other patriarchs that had multiple wives and kids through them, what tended to happen? There was plotting and there was scheming and there was, you know, trying to get the favored position, and there was, you know, discord between them as a result. Well, imagine all the lives that got affected as a result of the decisions that he made in doing all this, because this would have affected hundreds of families. You know, and who knows how many children, you know, that would be vying to get any of his attention, or to be the favored kid. I mean, just all the discord that this could sow amongst all of the people, this all came about as a result of his bad decisions, of his refusal to go, you know what, Moses said, don't do this, I won't do it. You know, if he had done that, all of this could have been skipped. And all of this pain that, you know, not only he himself went through, but his family went through, the entire nation goes through. And again, it works the same way for us. Our sins have a ripple effect to affect others. You know, and our decisions can have wide-reaching effects depending upon the nature of them. And it's important for us to realize, again, that the key issue is not just our understanding, it's the character to discipline ourselves and to follow what we know to be right. Well, let's notice how Solomon responds from all of this. Notice he has been told by God, basically, here's the sentence that you're going to receive for the mistakes that you've made. Because you've refused to do the right thing, you've refused to follow my instructions, here's the sentence I'm going to do to you. Now, what we're going to notice here is he doesn't have a reaction like his father David did when he really messed up. Because I'm sure we're all familiar with the story of, you know, David and Bathsheba or the matter of Uriah the Hittite, as the Bible refers to it. You know, when Nathan the prophet comes to David and shares with him, you know, you've really messed up and God's really upset with you, David's reaction is one of humility and one of repentance. I mean, he's repenting before God, asking for forgiveness and, you know, making amends to try to turn this around. He still suffers consequences from it, but that's his reaction. Solomon has a very opposite reaction to this situation. Let's pick up in verse 26. It's in 1 Kings 11, verse 26. Then Solomon's servant Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite from Zereda, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, also rebelled against the king. And this is what caused him to rebel against the king. Solomon had built the Milo and repaired the damages of the city of David, his father. And then Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing that the young man was industrious, made him the officer over all the labor force of the house of Joseph. Now it happened in that time that Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem with the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, and met him on the way. And he had clothed himself with a new garment, and the two were alone in the field. And Ahijah took hold of the new garment and was on him, and tore it into 12 pieces. And then he said to Jeroboam, "Take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord God of Israel, behold, I will tear the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon, and will give 10 tribes to you. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David, and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. Because they have forsaken me, and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Milcom, the god of the people of Ammon, and have not walked in the ways to do what is right in my eyes, and keep my statutes and my judgments, as did his father David." Now, notice also here, Solomon's example got all of the other, you know, a lot of the rest of Israel worshiping these pagan gods as well. That was part of the ripple effect, because they wound up following his example, you know, and getting involved in this pagan worship as well. In verse 34, "However, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, because I have made him ruler of all the days of his life, and for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose because he kept my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and give it to you, 10 tribes." So in other words, he's telling Jeroboam here, you know, you're going to be, you know, Solomon's replacement. In other words, well, after he dies, when, you know, after Rehoboam takes over, you're going to basically wind up being his replacement with the majority of Israel, is what's going to happen. And to his son, I will give one tribe, that my servant David may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, and the city which I have chosen for myself to put my name there. So I will take you, and you shall reign over all your heart desires, and you shall be king over Israel. Then it shall be, if you heed all that I command you, and walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, and my servant David did, then I will be with you, and build for you an enduring house, and I will build for David, and will give Israel to you, and I will afflict the descendants of David because of this, but not forever. But now notice Solomon's reaction to all of this in verse 40. Solomon therefore sought to kill Jeroboam. But Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. Now think about this. What Solomon is doing now is, you know, God has told him, look, you've blown it. I'm going to tear the majority of the kingdom away from you. And how does Solomon respond? His actions scream pretty loudly. It's obvious his thought process was something along the lines of, well, you can't replace me with a dead man. I'll just go chase down the guy and kill him. I'll outdo you. Does this story not sound familiar? I mean, think about this. This is Solomon who grew up being raised by his father David. David went through this same thing as well. Because Saul had been told by God, you know, I'm going to pull the kingdom away from you. I'm giving it to David. I've chosen him as your replacement. What does Saul do? He chases David around, trying to pin him to the wall with a spear, trying to kill him, because what's his thought process? You can't replace me with a dead man. Well, I'll kill him, and I'll prevail over God. I'll get my way. You'd think Solomon, having grown up with his father in his father's house, with his father as king, therefore knowing how the movie ended, you know, because by virtue of the fact that he winds up king himself means his dad prevailed. You know, God's will made it out here. You know, instead, what does he do? Think, I'll do the same thing. You can't replace me with a dead man. I'll go kill the guy. You know, those who know not learn the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them. You know, because it's kind of like I read the quote when we first started off, history repeats itself because no one was paying attention the first time. You know, and that's kind of what happened here. He didn't learn the lesson that this didn't work out too well for Saul. Logic would suggest not going to work out too well for me either. You know, so he tries to go down the same road and, of course, fails. Well, if you think about this, think about the massive transition that has taken place in this man's life. When we started off this sermon, you know, we read the story in 1 Kings chapter 3, where you have Solomon who is very small in his own eyes. You know, he says to God, I'm a little kid. I don't know how to go out, how to come in. I need you to give me a discerning heart. You define for me right from wrong. You show me the way that I should go. You know, and he's very much humble in looking to God. We see later in his life, what is he doing? The guy who has now been blessed with all of this wisdom by God, who was given all these riches by God, and he knows this is where he got it from, because he had a conversation with God about it, now thinks and has convinced himself he's going to outwit God, that he's going to be able to prevail against the will of God and somehow beat him. What has happened in this man's mind to bring about this huge change? Well, what we're going to do next time is look at the behind-the-scenes story of really the dynamics of what was going on in this man's mind and the decisions that he made that brought about this huge change throughout his life, because that's a whole other sermon all on itself. So at this point, I would basically say, well, I have to get adjourned at this point, and next time we'll pick up the story and explain again the behind-the-scenes story that Ecclesiastes tells us as to how he made this huge change in his life and where he went wrong. So at this point, I'll just say, tune in next time for Learning the Hard Way, Lessons from the Life of Solomon, Part 2.